From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For years, the journalist Michael Pollan has been writing about the American food system and efforts to reform it. Along the way, he realized the answer to the questions that kept coming up was one and the same: cook. Pollan says, you want to know the one thing an ordinary person can do to fix the problems with this system? The overprocessing, the disproportionate scale, the epidemic of obesity? The most important thing? Cook. In his latest book, he explains how cooking is central to our culture, our identity, our biology. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting our conversation with Michael Pollan about how cooking reconnects us with our families, our health, our communities, and also the deep kind of knowledge that can only be had by doing it yourself. Join us after the news.
This is John Shivick from Logan. I've been a sustainer for a year now. I've learned a lot since signing up. For example, I realized that, sure, Doug Fabrizio is a genius. He actually reads the books, watches the films, engages in conversations, but not like he's the only genius. Without the behind-the-scenes characters, those usually unheard on the airwaves, he'd be a guy on a street corner reaching out as far as his voice could carry. I had the pleasure of watching him at work in the studio once and realized how important the things were that Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark did. Do you know how much effort they put into injecting the right music at the right time? Screen calls, passing silent notes and emails back and forth to Doug while he's orchestrating an interview? On air, it sounds so seamless, doesn't it? That's because of who you don't hear. But it's not all them, either. There's another behind-the-scenes group, and it may be the most important one. Whose shoulders does the KUER staff stand on? The contributors, especially the sustainers. They couldn't do it without the powerful force behind the scenes, that is, us. So dial in right now and pledge to be a sustainer. Then, the next time someone brings up something that they heard on Radio West, turn to them and smugly say, I helped out with that. You couldn't have done it without me.
You can become part of the Radio West team by going online to KUER.org and making your donation. Thank you so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his latest book, the writer Michael Pollan has found an answer to the questions he's been getting at for years about the American food system, the political questions, the environmental questions, even the personal ones. Cook. That's the one-word answer to a pretty extensive collection of techniques that transforms what Pollan calls the raw stuff of nature into nutritious and appealing things for us to eat and drink. Turns out cooking is one of the most interesting and worthwhile things that we humans do, he says. And even though Michael Pollan did his share of cooking at home, he didn't realize just how central cooking was to our culture, to our biology, our identity. So for 3 years, he went around learning how to cook, to really cook. And in his book, he says he came away with a deep knowledge about the nature of work, about the meaning of health and community and self-reliance, tradition, and what he calls also the rhythms of everyday life. His latest book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael Pollan is the author of 7 books, including The Omnivore's Dilemma and In Defense of Food. And he's joining us today from the studios of Louisville Public Media in Louisville, Kentucky. He's there on book tour. Michael Pollan, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. Good to be back.
Well, I guess my first question was, what you've talked about, you write about in the book that cooking had always been a part of your life in some way, and you'd always done your share of cooking at home. But you hadn't really given it much thought in some way. So I'm wondering, when did this idea come to you? At what point?
Well, you know, for the last 10 years or so, I've been engaged in this journey exploring the American food chain,
yeah,
from the farm to the fork and into our bodies. And so in Omnivore's Dilemma, I really looked at agriculture and how we bring plants and animals that we eat out of the earth and how that's changed over the years. And then I kind of jumped ahead to the far end of the food chain, the body end, and looked at this whole question of nutrition and nutrition science to see what do we know about the links between our diet and our health. And as I explored those two kind of extreme ends of the food chain, I came to realize that the central link, the one where we, as you said, when we transform the stuff of nature into what we eat, has a powerful influence that goes both ways. Mm-hmm. That how we eat and who's cooking, are we cooking ourselves or are we letting corporations cook for us, has a tremendous bearing on what kind of agriculture we have. What drove the industrialization of agriculture and the move toward taking animals off farms and putting them on giant feedlots, the move toward monocultures of all kinds, was really driven by changes in the way we're eating, the fast food industry, the processed food industry.
Yeah.
And I realized at a certain point that this alternative food economy that's rising all over America is only going to get so far if people aren't willing to cook, because big companies are not going to buy from small farmers. They just don't know how to do it. It's too much trouble. There's a million reasons it's difficult for them to do. And then on the other side, as I started looking at this whole question of what keeps us healthy and what happens to food when it enters our bodies, I came to realize that the nutrients, which is what we obsess about, of course, are we getting enough of the good nutrients and are we avoiding the bad nutrients, really wasn't the key issue. The key issue was this food you were eating cooked by human beings or corporations?
Yeah.
And this was the most important determinant of a healthy diet.
You write about this, the idea when you set out to learn how to cook, these will break down the different elements as we go, but you say the idea wasn't necessarily to master something, but to attempt to cook something, you say, changes everything, you say, about our relationship to food and what is possible in the kitchen. How does it change us?
Well, it's in the same way that when you garden, you learn something really important about everything from the soil to the pests and the critters that molest your garden to what is a tomato, what is a tomato like, what makes tomatoes special. By doing things, we learn about things in a much deeper way than any other way. I mean, I really like hands-on learning, and this is what I've always done. When I wrote about architecture, I built a house and for a book called A Place of My Own. And when I wanted to write about the environment, I started growing food. And so it's a means of exploration for me. I read a lot, and my work is, you know, very thoroughly researched. But there's that missing element I can't get until I've actually put my hands on it. And so bread, the history of bread is, you know, fascinating, central to the history of civilization and the history of Europe. And but there are things you can learn about bread only when there's dough in your hands and you've watched that process unfold. So for me, it was an exploration. And this is not a how-to book by any means. It's much more a how-to-think-about-it book or a why-to book. But that's my mode. I really like to... put myself not in the story to be self-aggrandizing or I'm not a confessional writer, but because I don't know that much, that I am kind of an idiot when I start doing these things. And so that I like to tell the story of my education. And that's really what I'm doing here.
Yeah. The idea is to get people to think about food. I think this is how you put it in the book, in a real way, not see it as an abstraction.
Well, we need to reconnect with food. I mean, there's been a tremendous forgetting in our culture over the last 40 or 50 years about what food is. You know, way back when, everybody had a pretty good idea. They had direct involvement either with growing food, with cooking food, handling raw food. You know, when I wrote Omnivore's Dilemma, which is really just trying to answer the question, where does your food come from? This was a new job description. You could not sell a book telling people something so obvious 75 years ago. But that's a measure of how much has changed. And now food comes to us very carefully packaged with no information about its origins. Whatever information there is often a lie, is deception, you know, health claims or, you know, farm fresh eggs. I mean, what the hell does that mean? And so we're encouraged to think of food as something that comes from a factory and that is a thing. It's going to give us some entertainment. It's going to keep us alive. It's going to fuel us. But in fact, once you start cooking, once you start thinking about this stuff, you realize it isn't just a thing. It's a relationship. When you eat, you're in relationship to all to the species you're eating, to the farmer who grew it, to the person who picked it, to the person who cooked it, and you're also in a relationship to the people you're cooking for. And so it's a very profound thing, and I think we're undergoing a kind of you know, recalling of these facts right now. And that's a very exciting thing.
You mentioned, you know, being interested in the environmental part, the health part, but also a lot of this was really personal for you. You're in some way reconnecting with your son or connecting with your son, your relationship with your and your wife, too, I guess your family. I mean, this was personal in part.
Yeah. Well, you know, food is an amazing social medium. Yeah. And you know, as the family meal fades into the West, you know, we're losing that, too. We've become what's called secondary eating is now bigger than primary eating. Secondary eating is eating while you do other things, while you're watching television, while you're in the car, while you're walking down the street. Primary eating is what we used to call meals. We spend more time in secondary than primary eating. Primary eating is where we connect with our families, where very important things happen at the table. I really believe the family meal is one of the most important institutions of civilization. It's the nursery of democracy. It's where our kids learn to take turns, to share, how to converse, how to argue in a civil way. I mean, all these things happen at the table. They don't happen when kids go off to their rooms and their screens and they're grazing all day. For me, cooking and the family dinner are very tightly bound together. If you're going to cook a meal, you're going to sit down and enjoy it. The cook doesn't want, you know, demands that respect at least.
Yeah.
And people don't take what you cook and go off to their rooms and eat what you've made while they watch TV. And in my family, you know, my son, when I started this project, was 16. And like most teenagers, you know, he didn't have that much time for his parents. And but we found that around cooking, we could reconnect. Yeah. And one of the things we found we really enjoyed, my son does like to cook, and he'll often join us in the kitchen. And even if he's doing homework, he'll do it there at the counter at the island where we cook.
Yeah.
And that became a very sweet time together. And then he did get engaged in certain projects. I learned how to brew beer, and he took a keen interest in that, as you can imagine a teenager would. And it is a two-person job because you've got these heavy, you know, carboys to pour and move around. And we had a great time brewing beer together. And, you know, if you've got teenagers, you know the best way to engage with them sometimes is not face-to-face with direct eye contact. It's actually a lot better to be working side-by-side. Yeah. So getting your kids involved in the kitchen is, I think, a wonderful way to connect. And by the way, you're also teaching your kids one of the most important things you could give them, which is these life skills, how to cook, how to make a simple meal. Nothing will do more for their health long term. You know, we put a lot of attention into teaching them how to drive and teaching them about safe sex and teaching them about drinking and how to handle alcohol. Well, cooking is just as important a life skill.
You break the book down into four parts, and I guess these are parts that first occurred to your wife: fire, water, air, and earth. But you were kind of pleased with that little bit of symmetry when she mentioned it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, my wife, Judith Belzer, she's a painter, actually, but she's a great reader and is reading books all the time and reads all my work before it leaves the house. Mm-hmm. And I talk out my books with her on our hikes. And I was saying I wanted to reduce cooking to its, you know, it's fundamental principles. And it seemed to me that there were some basic transformations that no matter what culture you were in, you could divide cooking into. You know, however complex the recipes, they boil down to these four things. And I describe fire, which is the most obvious, grilling and cooking with fire and the oldest.
Yeah.
And water, which is cooking in pots with liquid. Doesn't have to be water, but water-based liquids. And then baking was air. Yeah. And then fermentation was earth. And I hadn't gotten much further than fire and water. And she said, well, it sort of sounds like you're talking about the classical elements. And I realized, you know, it did fit. I had to do a little, you know, shoehorning. People don't automatically think of air when they think of bread. But, of course, what is bread except porridge that we figured out a clever way to aerate? And, in fact, a loaf of bread is about 80% air.
Yeah. Well, fire is the first element you write about in the book. And this is how, really, you began your education, which led you, of course, to North Carolina. And you say in the book that you were looking for an idea and a taste that you had never experienced before. This is whole hog barbecue. Why did you start there?
Well, you know, I wanted to write about the most kind of primordial, unreconstructed cooking we have, yeah. The kind that goes back a couple million years probably, which is simply putting an animal over a fire. And what was the modern cognate of that? You know, the kind of cooking we do today that's most like that in its fundamental simplicity. Mm. And it was clear to me that it was Eastern North Carolina whole hog barbecue.
Yeah.
Now, if you know anything about barbecue, you know it's a highly contentious subject with different regions arguing over who has the true meaning of barbecue.
Right.
You just go west of Lexington in North Carolina, and they have a whole different idea of barbecue. But Eastern North Carolina is this really simple, no sauce, basically,
yeah.
Whole hog, slow-cooked over wood. You know, it's basically pig, wood, fire, and thyme. That's the recipe. And a lot of time. And so I thought that, and I had heard about this kind of barbecue, and I was really curious to try it. And I hadn't really had it. I'm a northerner, basically. Mm-hmm. And so I went down to North Carolina, and I connected with a couple pitmasters, but one in particular, a man named Ed Mitchell,
yeah.
Who is pretty famous in barbecue circles and does only whole hog, and was willing to really let me into his world and share his secrets, such as they were. And we cooked a few barbecues together on big public events where I was the Sioux pitmaster, I guess you would call it. And I learned a lot about the culture of barbecue, which is just fascinating. It's deeply woven into the history of tobacco in the South and the history of race. And Ed Mitchell is an African-American, and he said there are only two experiences in his life where the racial boundaries fell. And one was Vietnam, where he served, and the other was barbecue. Hmm. And even in the most racially charged times, if the good barbecue place in town was black, whites would line up at the takeout window. And if it was white,
yeah.
Blacks would line up at the takeout window. So it was the great common denominator in the South.
You note in the book that a lot of human cultures have practiced some form of animal sacrifice involving the roasting of meat over fire. And I like how you write about it. You say how many see this as a kind of a form or have any way of communication between humans and the gods. This idea of meat roasting on an open fire is really deeply embedded in us and really powerful, I guess.
It is. You know, I mean, we're the anomaly today that we eat meat without thinking about what's at stake. You know, that an animal has died for this and that it took a lot of work. And there is a kind of sacrifice of a living being to get meat. We just, you know, it comes in a shrink-wrapped package and that's it. But for most of history, eating meat was very consequential. And it was approached with a remarkable amount of ceremony. And you see the kind of shadows or echoes of that ceremony still in whole hog barbecue, where the pitmaster is a lot like a priest.
Mm.
And so I looked back at the Old Testament and I read Leviticus, which has all the rules for how to do a sacrifice, and the ancient Greece. I mean, you know, Homer is full of meat sacrifices.
Yeah.
And the brilliance of the sacrifice, you know, when sacrifice started, first there was human sacrifice. We sacrificed people.
Yeah.
And then we moved to animals. And then we realized, you know, the gods don't really need the meat, so we don't have to burn the whole thing up. What they really like is the smoke. And the smoke smells fantastic, and it does go up to the heavens. And how would you get the meat to them exactly anywhere? So we gradually kind of moved into this mode where God gets the smoke, and we get to enjoy the meat. And the meat then becomes this thing that binds the community together. And so meat eating is ceremonial. Cooking it over fire is a way to convey it to the gods. Mm. And they're always, and this is what interested me, lots of rules. Rules are the proper accompaniment for meat eating, like salt. And the reason for that is, I think, that when we first started eating meat over fire, this was a very charged thing. I mean, you didn't want a situation where the biggest and toughest man got all the meat. So you needed rules, and meat was so special, and people lusted for it, that you had to kind of control the group and tame everybody in order to share and take turns. And civilization really begins with these rules about meat eating. And some of them come down to us, of course, as the kosher rules.
Yeah.
But then we have the barbecue rules. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's not barbecue if it isn't whole hog,
right.
You know, and it's not barbecue if it's not ribs, as it is in, you know, say, Tennessee or Texas. Or it's got to be a pork shoulder if you're in Western. So rules just seem to accrete around meat eating. And I thought that was very interesting. And I was also interested by the fact that, you know, people who don't even know about the history of ritual sacrifice nevertheless are being informed by it in their everyday acts. I mean, I'm talking about the backyard barbecue,
yeah,
where the guy is, you know, there's always this self-dramatizing guy who's making it seem really complicated and is deciding when we're going to eat and who's going to get which cut. I mean, this guy in the backyard on the July 4th barbecue doesn't realize that he's inherited a deep ancient tradition that takes you back through the Old Testament to the ancient Greeks and probably way before that.
Mm. You know, you get to this question in the book, which you hear a lot of, you know, whether or not humans are the only creatures that do this. I mean, you hear it all the time. Are we the only ones that laugh? Are we the only ones that
right.
reason? Are we, you know,
have language?
Yeah. Have language. And you raise the question, so what do you think? Are humans the only creatures that cook?
Well, this was the belief for a long time. Yeah. And James Boswell in the 18th century said, you know, we are the cooking animal. And that's what sets us apart. All the other animals have, you know, reflection and consciousness and laughter and communication. Not all of them, but there are other animals that do.
Yeah.
We cook. And there is a sense in which cooking did set us apart from the animals, because when we learn to cook, which may go back as much as 2 million years before we were Homo sapiens. We were still Homo erectus then.
Wow.
But something happened then, which is our brains got a lot bigger than the other apes, and our guts shrank, our digestive apparatus. And the reason for that, according to something called the cooking hypothesis, which I explore in the book, it's a theory held by some anthropologists, is that when you cook food, it's much easier for your body to digest it. In effect, you're kind of digesting it outside your body, partly. And you don't have to chew it as much, and your body doesn't have to work as hard to... I mean, think about eating raw meat, how hard that is for your body to digest and handle. And so when we figured out this incredible technology called cooking, we suddenly had access to all this energy that other species didn't have. And that drove a major change in our evolution and made our brains bigger. And when our brains got bigger, we began to have culture. And one of the things that gave us culture is the fact that we were no longer, and this is going to sound funny, we no longer had to spend 6 hours a day, as the apes do, chewing.
Yeah.
The simple act of chewing takes up, that's why apes don't get anything done. they spend the entire day sitting around chewing raw vegetable products. Chimpanzees actually like meat and like to hunt, but they don't have enough time in the day to do it because they spend so much time chewing. So, you know, imagine, I mean, if you were spending 6 hours a day chewing, there would be no radio. There would be no culture.
Right.
There'd be no, you know, fun drives. so it was a big deal.
Yeah.
That said, I'm not sure Boswell was right. I have found examples of animals who cook. So once again, our arrogance has been defeated by clever animals. And here's the example. I include under the rubric of cooking fermentation, as you know.
Yep.
And that is another way we transform food without the use of heat. And there are many animals who ferment their food before they eat it. You know, think about the squirrel burying an acorn. Mm-hmm. We think he's hiding it. And that may be part of it, but what's really happening is that the microbes in the soil are beginning to sour or break down the grain, and that makes the grain much more digestible, much more nutritious. So any animal that buries its food in the earth is actually not just hiding it, but is fermenting it. Mm-hmm. And that, to me, qualifies as a kind of rudimentary form of cooking.
I want to mention, before we head into a break, one more cook that you write about in this section, on fire. Ed Mitchell and Samuel Jones, great characters in the book. And there's another cook you mention, a Spanish cook, Vitor Arguiñones. Arguiñones.
Yeah,
okay.
I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah, I wasn't either. But you say you met, which is great. You say you met him within 24 hours of cooking with Ed Mitchell. And you talk about the contrast in these two people. And for Bittor, cooking is about sacrifice. He didn't want you to help out, really. But I wanted you to say something about him, because the process for him was so much different from what you had seen, you know, with the pit masters.
Yeah.
Some of what he does is almost suggesting the element of heat in some ways to food.
Yeah, I was looking for someone who was updating the great ancient tradition of cooking with fire. And Bittor Aguinones has a restaurant called Echebarri in the Basque region of Spain. And it's an amazing place. Everything is cooked over fire, even the butter. But his understanding of fire is so subtle. And basically, he makes charcoal, hot coals, out of many different kinds of wood. And he perfumes his food with the wood. He won't even say it's smoke. It's more subtle than that. So he'll use forceps to take one particular coal that he likes the look of. He likes just how red it is or how white it is. And he'll put it under one scallop. And he'll watch it. And no one else can go near. And he'll turn it once. And he's looking for a slight change in the way it glistens that tells him it's as cooked as he wants it. And he has these grills that allow him to make micro adjustments in the height, and beautiful stainless steel grills. And this raging fire giving him this variety of coals. And he's making the most beautiful food. It sounds monotonous to have a 12-course meal that is all cooked over fire, but it's the furthest thing from monotonous. He's completely reinventing what it means to cook over fire. It's the most beautiful food, and if you ever get to that part of the world, you must try it.
Michael Pollan is with us. His book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer-journalist Michael Pollan. We're talking about his latest book called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. In the book, he breaks down the basic elements of cooking: fire, water, air, and earth. He says that cooking helps us patrol the borders between ourselves and nature's other creatures. Michael Pollan, if we were to distill down your section on water, would it break down to it being about time, taking the time to cook?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of it. In the section on water, which is about, you know, everyday domestic home cooking, it's kind of the opposite of the, you know, showy fire guy, self-dramatizing, you know, priest. And this is really about what a lot of us think of as drudgery, everyday home cooking. And this is the section of the book where I explore what stands between us and cooking today, which is to say a sense that we don't have time, we don't have skills, we regard it as drudgery. Since we have options that industry offers us to outsource cooking, many of us just stop doing it. And so it was a kind of about my getting my head around doing things I didn't like to do, like chopping an onion, which to me is kind of the metaphor for everything we regard as unpleasant or drudgery in scratch cooking. And I kind of learned, I mean, it was almost a Zen exercise in learning how to be in the kitchen without fighting myself about it. And I think that a lot of us struggle with that. Now that it's not obligatory to cook, why should we do it? And one of the reasons I discovered is for the sheer pleasure of it.
Yeah.
And approached in the right spirit, what you might have thought of as drudgery becomes alchemy or magic. As you watch what happens, as you learn the science of what's going on in front of you when you do something as simple as slicing an onion or salting a piece of meat or slow cooking something in liquid, and the way that the flavors develop and how you achieve umami in a dish, which is the, you know, the fifth taste that's translated as savoriness or deliciousness. And that the more I learned, the deeper I went into what was going on in this very ordinary space of my kitchen with these very ordinary ingredients in this work that had been done for, you know, hundreds or thousands of years, the more interesting it became. Mm-hmm. And the more vivid and more colorful this activity became, to the point where, you know, I don't mind chopping onions anymore. And I have a little koan, which is when chopping onions, just chop onions. And my teacher, who's this wonderful woman, former student of mine, actually, at the journalism school, who's a chef, professional chef, trained at Chez Panisse. Yeah. And she used to say that, look, cooking is all about patience, practice, and presence. And the presence is really hard for us to achieve, to really just be present in the kitchen, present to what we're doing, because we have so many other claims on our time and attention. So I did explore this issue of time. You know, we're down to 27 minutes a person spent cooking now. That's half as much time as we spent in the 60s, and 4 minutes cleaning up. And there are millions of Americans who spend more time watching other people cook food on television than they spend cooking themselves. So if you're wondering where you might get the time to cook, there's one idea.
There it is. Well, it's a larger theme. You deal with this question that we didn't always have, but the difference between work and leisure.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have come to define work and leisure in very narrow ways, and ways that, by the way, the marketplace wants us to understand it as, which is to say that work is what we do when we're getting paid.
Yeah.
And we do, you know, as little of it as we can get away with. And then we use our time for leisure, which is defined as consumption. The idea you might work for pleasure doesn't get admitted into the whole equation. So anything you can outsource, anything someone else can do for you, you should. You should take the money you make from your job and then use that money to buy services so you don't have to do anything else except leisure, which becomes another occasion for consumption. Mm. I have to tell you, this is a really kind of perverted way to think about things. There is enormous pleasure to be had in production, making things. And that's what the DIY, this do-it-yourself movement that's going on around the country is all about. It's what home gardening is all about. It's not efficient to grow your own food, necessarily. It's not efficient to cook, necessarily, although I do think it is really economical. And in fact, there I quote the Zagats, the restaurant guide people, who had an op-ed that I read in the Wall Street Journal that really captured, I think, everything that's wrong with the way we think about work and leisure. And they said, you should stay at work longer, work another hour, do what you do well, make more money, and then go to a restaurant and let them do what they do well. So in other words, we should all be highly specialized, do our one thing, and then pay for everything else. Well, that outsourcing of such important parts of human life strikes me as a tremendous mistake. It breeds dependence. It breeds a sense of helplessness. I mean, if we're dependent on restaurants to eat, I don't want to go there. And one of the kind of subliminal political messages of this book is that it's enormously satisfying to get good at something that you're not doing for money,
right,
that you're doing for pleasure. And to join the producers of the world feels really good. I mean, consumption is, you know, the definition of us as consumers is one of the more belittling definitions I think we have. I don't think we're at our best when we're consuming. I think we're at our best when we're making. And we're at our best when we're providing for ourselves and our families. So that's a whole other kind of philosophical or I would say even spiritual reason to cook. The pleasure, the satisfaction of making something and putting a little space between you and this all-powerful market that's trying to insinuate itself into every nook and cranny of your life.
If water marked, because you write about how water sort of marked in some ways the beginning of an agricultural revolution for humankind. So let's talk about air. Air, bread making, really, I guess, marked kind of the beginning of this long, slow process that eventually led us to the point, if I get it right, Michael Pollan, of processed food. Was that the transformation in part?
Yeah. I mean, One of the subtexts of the book is I was really interested in that for most of history, the way we cooked or processed our food, beginning with that first fire, made it more nutritious, easier to digest, better for us, and it improved our lot. So when we can cook with pots, too, we had and this happens about 10,000 years ago, that technology, and we needed ceramics to be able to do that, opened up all new ways we could eat. We could eat things we could never eat before. We could eat grain because you could soften seeds and make them edible in water. And suddenly you could feed old people, even if they didn't have teeth. People could live longer as soon as you could cook in pots. And you could wean babies earlier if you wanted to because you could make gruels and soups. And then 6,000 years ago, we get this amazing new technology called bread, which is essentially a porridge, right, of a paste of ground grain and water that has been inoculated with a yeast actually a whole culture of yeasts and bacteria, and it starts bubbling and it starts getting bigger. And when we recognized that, it was probably an accidental discovery, and put it in an oven, the result was so much better in terms of flavor and nutrition than that porridge we started with, because the fermentation unlocked the minerals and the proteins and the carbohydrates in those seeds, which were kind of locked up. And then the heat, the loaf of bread itself is a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
Because in a boiling pot, you can only get up to the boiling point. But if you're steaming, you can get much, much hotter. And that's what happens in every air pocket in a loaf of bread. So you're thoroughly cooking the carbohydrates, making them much more easy to digest and more delicious. So a big win for humanity. And you could not survive on flour alone. You could survive on bread alone. But then something weird happens. Long about 1880s, we figure out a milling technology. We used to just grind this grain on stones. So you got the bran, the germ, and the starch, the endosperm. But with roller mills, we figured out how to shear off the bran and the germ. Yeah. And there had always been a prestige attached to white flour for various reasons. It was more elite. It took more money because you had to sift it many times to get it white. And it was easier on your teeth because in those days, wheat was, tough on your teeth. You would lose your teeth from eating too much bread.
Yeah.
But we went too far, and we took all the nutrition out of flour because the endosperm is just basically pure starch, more or less. And we took something that was incredibly healthy, and we made it a public health disaster. And we had all these nutritional deficiencies as soon as we figured out how to refine white flour. And that is really the beginning of industrialized food. Food that is processed to appeal to our desires, which in this case is for sweetness and easily absorbed food. But mostly it serves the interest of industry because white flour is not perishable. You could do it on a mass scale. It didn't have to be fresh. You could put it on the shelf. One mill could service, a whole country. And I think that begins a fateful turn where food processing is no longer really contributing to our health and, in fact, is doing just the opposite. Mm.
There are those, of course, who are trying to kind of turn us back. Say something, if you would, about Dave Miller, whom you once described as the bread monk.
Yeah. Well, I was looking for bakers who were doing really interesting things with whole grain. And there is this very exciting revival of whole grain baking. A lot of us have memories of, kind of virtuous brown bricks,
right.
Kind of hippie brown bread. And,
yeah.
That has a certain appeal, but it turns off a lot of people.
Yeah.
It is more virtuous than delicious very often. But Dave Miller is a baker near Chico. And on a given day when I was doing this research, I had this really interesting day. I went to a Wonder Bread factory and where they put out 155,000 loaves a day.
Right.
And they can cook a loaf of bread in like 3 or 4 hours with lots of chemical help. And it's a really sophisticated operation. And then I went to Dave Miller, who is an artisan who works alone in a very meditative way and sells his bread exclusively at the farmer's market one day a week, makes 500 or 400 loaves a week, and makes a living on that. And he was the bread monk. He's just bakers are just so intent and intense on what they're doing. And here's the interesting thing. You would think Dave Miller is the past and Wonder Bread is the future.
Right.
Well, Wonder Bread has gone bankrupt,
yeah.
And that factory is closed. And Dave Miller is thriving. And Dave Miller was able to sell his beautiful whole grain bread. And he mills the flour himself fresh every day that he's baking. And if you've ever had bread made with flour that was milled that day, it's a revelation. You understand why it's called flour. I mean, it's incredibly fragrant like a flour. I realize it's spelled differently, but there is an etymological connection there. And he's doing just fine because there is this revival of interest in real bread. Mm-hmm. And, you know, whatever you think of Wonder Bread, it's a very complex product. It's got 20 or 30 ingredients, and it never goes stale.
Well, we didn't get to the section on earth, so I'll leave it to readers to go there, which is broken down in these three chapters, the fermentation of vegetables and of milk and of alcohol. Now that you've learned these things, Michael Pollan, I wonder how has your life changed? Because you say in the book, something sticks, some things
yeah.
don't. But you must have learned something of yourself.
I did. I learned a lot. For me, you know, cooking is a lot like gardening, and especially the arts of fermentation, where you're dealing with other living species, even though they're invisible. Mm. Fermentation is a negotiation between us and these bacteria, and they have their own interests, and you have to honor their interests and kind of guide them. You can't control them. You have to give up these illusions of control, much like being a gardener. And for me, the arts of fermentation have really stuck. I'm always making kimchi. I always have some beer, you know, that I've made in the basement. I find that endlessly exciting. And but I'm also baking, and I never thought I would do that. I thought I would learn how to bake for the book, and that would be it. But I found that it's incredibly soothing to put your hands on dough, and it's very sensual, the baking process. And now I've thrown out the recipe books, and I still need to weigh my ingredients. But after that, it's all by touch and smell and taste and watching how this dough is developing over the course of a day. And I do it while I'm writing, and I just come down every 45 minutes or an hour. You don't have to be precise, and just give it a little turn, see how it's doing. And then when it's time to bake, I bake it, and then this miracle happens, and I still get this amazing sense of satisfaction. I mean, it's almost as good as finishing an article when a beautiful, fragrant, risen loaf comes out of the oven. So all this surprised me, just how much pleasure I get out of this so-called work.
You know, you write about this near the end of the book, about this relatively brief encounter you had with this lovely Korean woman in Seoul, where you learned to make traditional kimchi. And you say this about that, Michael Pollan. You say it was an experience that in some ways helped you find yourself in the kitchen. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Sure. Well, I went to Seoul, South Korea, and I did want to learn how to make kimchi. I mean, they have a wonderful tradition of fermentation there. And so I'm working with this woman, and she's showing me how to do it. And it's this very complicated process with this red paste that you make of all the spices. And then you have to individually rub them into each leaf. And you leave the cabbage intact, and you fold it just so, and you put it into the urn, and you bury it outside. And she started talking about the distinction between hand taste and tongue taste. Now, we were working with a translator. She didn't speak English. I didn't speak Korean. And I didn't know what she meant. This sounded like a crazy idea. And I had to keep asking questions. And it eventually became clear. And it's a beautiful distinction. She said tongue taste is the chemistry of flavor. It's what, you know, even an artificial flavor, even McDonald's can do tongue taste. It's a superficially satisfying taste on the tongue. And you can simulate it even if you want. But then there's something called hand taste. And hand taste is the unmistakable signature of the person who made the food. And you can tell the care that's been put into it, just the way it's cooked. And we've all had meals like that, that are made with such conviction by someone. It might be a great chef. It might be, you know, your grandmother. But that there is this secret ingredient, and that secret ingredient is love, really, and caring. And you can't fake that. And learning how to put hand taste into your food and recognize it when someone's giving it to you is just one of the deeper meanings of cooking and something that industry will never do for us. So that's what I strive for. A loaf of bread, a kimchi, a braise, a stew, that has that. That has that sense of I really cared about everything. And maybe you'll notice, maybe you won't, but it's going to make you feel really good. And the reason is because there's hand taste there.
Michael Pollan, his book is called Cooked, A Natural History of Transformation. Michael Pollan, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you very much, Doug.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our theme music was composed by The Moth and the Flame, thanks to Taylor Almond and Susan Anderson. The program is produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.